My first guest, I have Tim Quinn, Utah Legislative District 54, representing Wasatch County and Park City, on the line. Thank you, Tim. Appreciate you being here this morning.
Thanks, Carolyn, for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, so the state's Tax Restructuring and Equalization Task Force recently finished its statewide tour, visiting communities throughout the state to present ideas and receive public input on this ongoing tax reform effort. Tim, you are a member of the task force and a state legislator representing Wasatch and Summit counties. And I just wonder what your thoughts are in terms of the wrap-up, and were there common themes that you heard from Utah residents as you did this statewide tour?
Yes, we, as you well know, we had 8 meetings for tax reform. We were north, we were in Bergen City. South, we were in St. George, places in between, Kearns, Utah, Richfield, Moab, and others. I even attended one of the town halls that the Democratic Party put on in Wasatch County for Wasatch and Summit residents. The main theme that we heard, the main themes that we heard were, well, the Top Bar Association, the trial lawyers, they kept saying, hey, we think it's a good idea, just don't tax us. Utah Taxpayers Association said, you know, be very leery of taxing business inputs, which we wouldn't be.
Tim, we're getting a lot of cutting out on your line. Are you in a place where you're having trouble with the connection?
I didn't think so. I actually pulled over so that I wouldn't lose the call.
Okay. Okay. This sounds a little bit better.
Okay.
I'm sorry. You mentioned the Utah trial lawyers. They believe in the tax, but not on them.
Correct. And that we heard a lot of that. You know, we understand the problem. We understand the solution. We think it's a good solution. Just don't tax us type of mentality. But I think there are those in the audiences who said we need to restore the full sales tax on food. I'm frankly opposed to that. I think most of your listeners know I ran a bill in 2017 to remove sales tax on food completely. It passed in the House but did not pass in the Senate. There are those who are saying let's have a statewide property tax. I'm opposed to that because we have so many who are on fixed incomes. Young families just starting out, elderlies, who I think it continues to damage them. But we do have 7 or 8 or 9 viable options, I believe, or valid options that we will be considering in our working meetings. I think you know and have reported that our first one will be Monday down at the Capitol. I believe it starts at 4:30. It's a public meeting. And we know that we'll have plenty of public input at that meeting to get us started on a working solution for the problem that faces us.
Yeah, the report shows a lot of support for a carbon tax, a state lottery, and a tourism tax. And it shows little support for, and basically opposition to, eliminating the education fund and expanding taxes to services. So how will you approach that? I mean, is there, you know, the possibility, is that one of those 8 or 9 options, a carbon tax, a state lottery, tourism tax?
I don't believe so. It's that carbon tax. We heard that from Representative Briscoe. We heard it in the regular session in the Revenue Tax, which I co-chair or vice chair of that committee. I know there's a ballot initiative of which the representative who's sponsoring the carbon tax bill is opposed to because it's a very complicated mechanism to put in place for taxation. So when you say there's broad support, I honestly don't know if I heard in 7 of the 8 meetings that I attended anyone talk about a carbon tax. As far as a lottery, yeah, there were some fringe discussions about a lottery. But I think that the main things that people looked at were the food tax, the property tax, a sales tax on some services, or even doing what we call a credit on the income tax form, so it just shifts money from income tax to the general fund without raising any taxes. And let me be clear, Carolyn, my entire reason for running 441 last year, I think the entire reason for this task force is not to raise revenue. We're not saying we have a shortage of funds in the state of Utah. We're just saying we don't have enough money in the general fund, which funds roads and prisons and courts and Medicaid and everything else that the government does, state parks, everything that we do outside of primarily education. So we're not looking to raise funds. We're just looking to shift them. And one of the things you mentioned was, frankly, there was a lot of discussion, a tremendous amount of discussion for removing that firewall from education. So that's one of the options that the task force will look at as well. What does that mean going forward? I think that it's a viable option if we put some type of floor into education funding statutorily that says, you know, all the funds are going to be put together and we can divvy them out how the legislature sees fit, but we can never go below a certain percentage of the state budget to be funding education. That's a better guarantee to the education system than the one we have now, because nothing, even though the Constitution says there's this firewall, nothing prevents us from lowering the income tax rate. I mean, theoretically, we could even do away with the income tax. So the education system doesn't really have a true guarantee. I'd rather see a true guarantee of a certain percentage of state budget. We know what the budget is every year, that it's been growing at a tremendous pace. So why not do away with the firewall, but put some type of floor in so that we make sure we have a real and sustainable guarantee for education going forward.
Yeah, so there is still time for Governor Herbert to call a special session addressing tax reform before the general session in 2020. As the task force moves forward in these discussions, are you getting any hints as to whether a special session will happen?
To say if I'm getting any hints, no, I'm not. But that was the intent. When we put this task force together at the end of the session in March, it's been kind of the discussion moving through this process. But as far as a date, we've not really talked about it because we want to make sure we get this right. We would rather do it during the general session instead of a special session if we needed that much time to get it right. But I think it does need to be done. It does need to be done as quickly as possible, because we do face some serious challenges with our budgeting restraints and where the revenue is coming from in the state. And social services, which is the largest portion of our budget, social services is paid for through the general fund, and the general fund is lagging behind.
Okay. Let me just get a little bit of an update, and this is a much more extended conversation. Hopefully we'll talk more about that, but I'm sure you know the topic of the Extel Mida Ski Resort project. It's been all over the news this week. It's a 5,600-acre area east of Deer Valley. It's right here in our backyard in the Wasatch Back. It's in your district. What do you think about the bill that grants this development authority to MIDA?
You were breaking up a little, just like you said I was earlier, but I think I heard you say, what do I think of the bill that allows for this development?
That allows for the development authority to go to MIDA.
Yeah. That happened before my tenure in the legislature, but I do have some concerns with it. I think the intent of MIDA is good, but I think it has the ability to be abused. I'm not suggesting, because I don't know the details of this particular development, other than it is very, very large. I'm not accusing anyone of malfeasance with this particular development, but it's certainly, through a MIDA development, it allows for abuse, and I hope that that's not the case. My concern for my district, Wasatch County and Park City, and I've had many conversations with the mayor up in Park City, with Mayor Bierman, who I think he and I have a wonderful working relationship together, but is growth. We all are dealing with it. We know that it's coming, and there's not, we can't put up gates and stop people from coming, but our developments and our zoning needs to be done in a responsible way, making sure that infrastructure is in place for this type of growth that we're experiencing. So I hope that caution was used when this development was approved and as it continues to go forward, but I'm not a huge fan of allowing some of these types of developments to come underneath that MIDA umbrella.
Yeah, you've always seems like you've always been a defender of local control. And I'm just wondering, have you heard very much from your constituents in Wasatch County?
I haven't, and probably because, and this is a sad commentary, but most of the residents down in Wasatch County, we're kind of in this bowl of mountains. Once you get over into the Jordanelle side of things, the residents in Hideout and Deer Mountain and so forth, those are the ones who are going to be more affected than the majority of those living down here in the Heber Valley. But I know I haven't honestly heard much about it. I've had one person contact me about that development over the last 6 months.
Yeah, sure. You know, and I think one of the things that really stands out with this development is that it's potentially a brand new ski resort for, you know, this area, because there is no operating agreement yet with Deer Valley. And there is, you know, there appears to be the ability in terms of the area to create its own, you know, standalone ski resort and operate independently of, you know, both the Alterra Deer Valley operation or even the Vail operation. So, yeah, it's something to watch and something that oversight will be interesting to see how that evolves over the years.
Right. And yeah. One of the concerns I think everyone ought to have is what will this do to the already congested intersection of 40 and 248? I did have several constituents out in that area, Browns Mill and Browns Canyon and 248, and I'm contacting UDOT to see about a traffic light there because it's become a dangerous intersection. Anytime an incredibly large development like this comes in that could affect that traffic even more is a concern, not only for convenience sake and time management, but for safety as well. So I hope that those that approve this development looked at traffic flow and made sure that it's not going to impact in a negative way, particularly that intersection of 248 and 40.
Yeah. Hey, just quickly, the Health and Human Services recently said it would deny Utah's request for a Medicaid waiver, which would give 90% funding to a more limited Medicaid program. So that means the next step, as written into this year's Medicaid expansion bill, is basically to fully expand to up to 138% of the poverty line. And it seemed like when all this was happening, lawmakers were pretty confident that they would get the waiver. And tell me what's happening next. Has this thrown a wrench into the tax conversation?
Well, certainly. And I apologize because I'm hearing only parts of what you're saying, so I hope that that's not occurring as I speak back. But certainly, yes, it threw a wrench into it. We've been getting email updates from the House staff as to what's going on with those waivers not being approved and what does that mean for the bill that was passed. We did have a contingency plan in place within the bill in case the waivers did not happen. So the expansion will continue to move forward. So no one's in jeopardy because those waivers were not approved. But to be honest with you, Carolyn, I have spent all summer working on this task force and traveling the state and working on tax issues. I have been reading the updates, but I haven't delved into Medicaid a lot. There are those who are much more versed in that subject than me. So I've been concentrating on taxes. As though those who are working on Medicaid come up with a solution, I'm sure we'll hear about it. Perhaps even next week in our interim meetings, that may be a topic of conversation, but I look forward to making sure that we uphold the wishes of the people who voted for Medicaid expansion, and we do it in the most fiscally responsible way that we can to ensure that the program is sustainable. So as we move down that path, I will let you guys know where we're headed and how we might accomplish that.
Well, thanks so much, Tim, for joining us this morning, and we will keep in touch because I think as things evolve next week, it sounds like Monday is the first meeting that you'll be holding.
Correct.
And people can come. It's an open meeting. Can people give input still on this tax reform?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I get emails every day with suggestions of things more about what we shouldn't do. I wish I had greater suggestions about what we should do, but yes, people are still putting input in, and are given input. And that meeting, I believe, again, is at 4:30. It's at the Capitol in the House building downstairs in room 30.
Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Have a great weekend, Tim.
You too. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye now. That's Tim Quinn. He is House District 54 representing Park City and Wasatch County. It's 8:31. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. My next guest is Becca Gerber with Park City Council. She is here to, well, maybe start us off with that first item that was on the agenda last night, which discussed allowing e-bikes on the natural trails, the dirt trails. And it seems like most everyone who gave public comment spoke in favor of allowing them. And although Steve Joyce referred to a survey that happened just a year ago that was pretty overwhelmingly against e-bikes on dirt trails. And so there's a discussion about doing another survey, Becca?
Yes. And so I think the feedback was really a mixed bag. We heard a little bit from both sides. We did hear there's some concern from some land conservancies and land trusts about the easements that are placed on some of our open space parcels that restrict the use of motorized vehicles, which would include a motorized e-bike. So that was a concern that was presented to us. And then, you know, there are a lot of people in town that are really worried about how busy our trails feel and wanting to make sure that, you know, we kind of hold on to some of our residents feel very strongly about not allowing e-bikes on the trails. And we did hear from some of them. But then on the other hand, we do have an aging population that has, you know, done so much for our community over the years and has really created the trails and now wants to still be able to use them in their later years and really need the assist from an e-bicycle. So I think that that's something that we understand and appreciate their desire to still be able to have the freedom to be able to explore all of the great trails that many of them have actually built for us over the years. And then we also heard from a Vietnam War vet that has some medical issues that he uses an e-bike to still be able to access the trails. And we have heard some ADA concerns. And as we're having our social equity discussion, I think it does even apply to some of these things like the trails, where we're really embracing a diverse, neurodiverse community and a different ability community to be able to use our trails. So I think that where we landed was that we would like to continue this discussion. We do want to do another survey and really hear from our residents how they feel about having e-bikes on the trail. And at the same point in time, look at a way to create a permit system for people over a certain age and with disabilities to be able to use an e-mountain bike on our trails sooner.
Yeah. So is there going to be another survey?
There will be another survey. Okay. And I guess I should also say, I do believe that people with disabilities are currently allowed to use an e-bike on the trail, but we don't have a way of permitting them or creating some sort of notification on their bike so that to let other bikers know that they do have a disability and they need the e-bike to be able to access the trails. And that was one of the more concerning things I think we heard, is that people are actually harassing some people that are using e-bikes for disability use. And we want to be a welcoming and embracing community and help people understand why people are using different pieces of equipment.
Yeah, I mean, there are safety issues associated with e-bikes. They mm-hmm. go a lot faster than a human will pedal. They're heavier. They're mm-hmm. not probably as responsive. We have technical trails. We have rocks mm-hmm. and stumps and sticks and gravel and mm-hmm. berms and all those things. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting
It is. And some
challenge.
Of the things we've heard, that the e-bikes actually have speed restrictions, so they don't go over 20 miles an hour. And I think that even slows them down maybe when they're going downhill, so they don't go as fast. I think someone mentioned that they are heavier. And I have never used an e-mountain bike, so I couldn't tell you yeah. the difference. But they do have some speed restrictions. And I think a lot of the people that are using them to go uphill, I think yeah. The comment was made that, you know, there's different range of speeds that people ride their bikes anyways these days, and there's people that are going up more slowly and more cautiously, and then there's a lot of young whippersnappers out there that can just charge up, and I know that I've experienced that myself.
Yeah, and Council Member Lynn Wehrpeek mentioned mm-hmm. that the trails are narrow, and mm-hmm. would there possibly need to be more trails that are built for mm-hmm. e-bikes to accommodate that different kind of equipment? And I was up on the trails. I'm up a lot, and I saw a couple of guys, big guys, on e-bikes mm-hmm. coming up off of Dawn's Trail, and they were pushing the e-bikes mm-hmm. and I think maybe I don't know what had happened, but mm-hmm. they were not coming up the hill fast. They were pushing those heavy bikes up the hill, which maybe makes you think that they had come off of it and they couldn't get going again. I don't know. I don't know. But you know, some of the trails really are not meant to accommodate that kind of equipment, I think. Mm-hmm. So it will be interesting. And, of course, the social equity issue around it and where our town stands on, you know, dealing with those issues. That's all part of the conversation. So,
exactly.
And then another item that drew a lot of public comment and, well, or interest and discussion was the Old Town circulation and access update, and a lot of people making a lot of different suggestions. What was your takeaway from what the community would like to see happen with Old Town traffic circulation?
So really what we were presented with was the opportunity to do a more comprehensive Old Town circulation study. We've been hearing from lots of our residents in Old Town that our traffic flow is broken, and we understand that. You can see it in the wintertime. There are backups on almost every road from Marsac to Park Ave, Main Street, and we understand that it's become very uncomfortable for a lot of our residents living in Old Town, and we are very concerned about the livability in Old Town. And we have also heard from our Main Street businesses that it isn't creating the best environment for them either. And really, for what feels like the first time since I've been on council, we're bringing together a lot of different pieces of this conversation. We're really working with the lodging community, the taxi stakeholders. We've done community outreach to the neighborhood residents. And we've brought a lot of people in to kind of talk about where we want to go with this Old Town circulation project, and then talk about some less invasive things we can do right away to hopefully make things a little bit better. Some of the things that were discussed in addition to the Old Town circulation study are some CVM or commercial vehicle drop-off areas, or CV drop-off areas. Mm-hmm. So we are going to talk about taking a couple of spaces off of Main Street and using those as drop and load zones for both our taxis and our lodging partners, so that they have an area where they can pull over and get out of traffic on Main Street, allowing traffic to continue past them, and also providing a better service for their guests where they can get in and out of the cars and not feel like they're being rushed or hurried. So that was one thing that is being discussed. We are talking about wayfinding in Old Town. We understand that a lot of people get to the top of Main Street and they're not sure which way to go, and then they end up in our residential neighborhoods making awkward turns and trying to pull in and out, and we understand that that's a mess. So we are going to make some efforts to make it a little bit easier to figure out how to get in and out. So those are some short-term things that we're looking at, and then there are more long-term solutions. And we did hear a lot from our community, and we've heard concerns about Uber and Lyft and Google Maps and how that navigates people through our town. And these are things that are harder for us to control, but we do want to take a look at anything we can to help make this process better. And
how receptive do you think our visitors who come from all over the world will be to the idea that they might have to walk a block or two or three in order to get where they're going, rather than just being dropped door to door and, you know, having eight stops along Main Street where a shuttle driver, what are the thoughts on that?
You know, it's hard. There's a lot of give and take. I don't know how they would feel about having to walk a block versus having to sit in the car for 5 minutes while another shuttle in front of them unloads in the middle of the street and their shuttle is stuck there. So there's a give and take to this discussion. We've heard from our lodging community, you know, they do have very high service standards and they do want to be able to get their guests as door to door of a service as they can. But I think they understand the traffic issues that we're dealing with as well, and they have come to us with some voluntary efforts that they're willing to make. So it's complicated on all sides, but we know that there's a problem, and so we just have to start pulling at the threads and start trying to make things a little better.
So maybe we'll see some things go into place for this winter.
Exactly.
Just trials and see how it works, and people be giving feedback. Just quickly, the Park City School District Superintendent Jill Gilday and School Board President Andrew Kaplan presented their master plan to the council. Now, you're a parent of a young child, and I know it doesn't seem like it, but you will very soon be looking into some early childhood education soon. It's going to happen faster than you think.
And I know.
What do you want to see as a pre-K option for our town?
I am really grateful that our school district is looking at universal pre-K, and even from 0 to 3, and then 4 and 5 year old, or 3 and 4 year olds going into kindergarten and beyond. And so I appreciate them taking a look at this discussion, but I know that they have a long ways to move through it, and the city is very supportive of working with them, working with the Community Foundation to find options for universal pre-K. We know that investments in early childhood education are very important, and they will actually save us a lot of money in the future. So, you know, we didn't get too deep into it, but I'm very excited that that's something that our school district is being so progressive about and looking into.
Yeah, so does the city have a role in terms of the visioning of our school district?
We are supportive of them going through the process and are here to support in any way that we can if they need it. And we have actually had quite a few people. I've heard from some people that they feel like that's one thing that's been missing from our visioning process is a discussion of the education. So that is something that we brought up about being able to incorporate at some point in time. But I really like the line that Dr. Gilday used. She said, you know, strong, unified communities have strong, unified schools, and we really do go hand in hand. So I believe that we are open to supporting this process in whatever ways we can.
Okay, great. It's been a long and inclusive process that has involved many, many hundreds of people.
And there are still a long ways to go.
And they've got a lot of work. Mm-hmm. So stay tuned, pay attention. We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Becca Gerber, for joining us this morning on the Local News Hour.
Thank you.
Thanks. It's 8:43, and my next guest is Frank Zhang. He's Vice President of Communications for Larry H. Miller Tour of Utah. Thank you for joining us. Frank, are you there?
Yes, good morning. How are you today?
I'm great. So let's start off with a recap of the tour so far. Do you want to give us a rundown of who I'm kind of curious about who the fan winner is so far as of yesterday.
Well, we are highly anticipating what is going to be day 5 of 7 days of racing in our professional stage race known as America's Toughest Stage Race with the Tour of Utah. Today is the circuit race around Salt Lake City, and then we will get ready to come up to Summit County for a big weekend finish in Park City. This is actually the 15th edition of the Larry H. Miller Tour of Utah. I mean, it's come a long ways from a weekend event at Thanksgiving Point to now being one of the desired races on the international racing calendar and certainly one of the premier cycling events in North America. So we've had a great week so far. I mean, the name that's the guy with the yellow jersey right now is Ben Hermans, who is from Belgium. And he races for the Israel Cycling Academy. As noted, this is an incredibly tough course. And stage 2 on Tuesday was a climb to the very tippy top of Powder Mountain Resort at 9,000 plus feet. And he conquered all. And that gave him the yellow jersey. And then yesterday we had a ride from Antelope Island State Park to North Salt Lake. And again, on the final climb, he surprised the field because he didn't really need to sprint it in and passed everybody on the last climb and retained the yellow jersey and has about a 44-second lead right now as we prepare for Friday's race here in Salt Lake City with the circuit race around the avenues and the state capitol. So it's been a good week of racing so far, but we've got 3 more stages still to go.
Yes, you do. Well, that's interesting. We'll be watching Ben Herman then. So how have the crowds been? What has the support been like for the tour?
You know, we've had really good crowds all week long. We've gone some new places. So, you know, like the Tour de France and other cycling events, the route changes every year. So for the first time, we went to North Logan City and did circuits there. Yesterday was the first time we've been in North Salt Lake. On Saturday, we're going to go over the Olympic Parkway at Utah Olympic Park for the first time ever. But then it's a healthy mix of the fan favorites, such as the circuit race and the Park City weekend finish, along with some new spots as well. You know, traditionally, we'll probably total about 400,000 spectators that will be on the race course. The beauty of cycling is that, and of this event, it's free to spectators. I mean, think of another professional sport that you can go to for free. And it can be as easy as watching it from the end of your driveway to coming to one of the start-finish line areas where there's a lot of atmosphere and a lot of spectator and fan activities that take place. And then, you know, honestly, the biggest reach comes through television. I mean, this event has the potential to reach 400 million people on five continents with the broadcast feed. It's on national TV here in the United States. And just because of the popularity of cycling throughout the world, the television, the broadcast reach is quite remarkable and really gives us the chance to showcase the state of Utah through the eyes of sport. We describe it a lot as a rolling postcard because you get to see so much of the beauty and terrain of Utah as we're going on the different roadways and mountaintops and scenic byways of the state.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about tomorrow for just a minute, because the Canyons Village is a new stage for the tour. The start and finish is there, is that correct?
Yes. So for the first time, Canyons Village at Park City Mountain is hosting both the start and the finish. You know, it's a winding trail across Summit County. The race will go by Jordanelle and Rockport Reservoirs. In total, we'll be riding 85 miles and doing a little over 5,000 feet of climbing. There are sprint lines in Camas and Hoytsville, and then we'll do some of the mountain terrain around Jordanelle and Browns Canyon as well. We will circle back through Kimball Junction. They'll work their way through the top of Utah Olympic Park, and then it'll be a fast downhill through Bear Hollow Drive and then onto the Canyons Resort Drive to the finish line as well. So the Saturday race is, we certainly have our main stage with the Tour of Utah, but we also have a citizens race that will take place a little bit earlier in the day as well with the Ultimate Challenge.
That's right.
So there's a couple different events that will be happening on the Canyons Village side of the community on Saturday before we get to the race.
Yeah, and we just have a couple more seconds here, but the of course the big finish, start and finish on Main Street, and that's where the riders will be coming up that Pine Canyon Road out of Midway, and the crazy ride down the Mine Road and finishing uphill on Main Street.
You know, that course has not changed. I mean, why would we mess with such a good thing, to be honest with you? That course was first introduced in 2012. It's a 78-mile stage ride, 10,000 feet of climbing on Sunday. This is actually the 10th year that Park City has served as a host city, and it's the seventh time it's going to host the final stage. So no doubt, it's one of our most popular stages, and we look forward to the big finish on Sunday. That race will start at about 12:30 on Main Street and then finish about 3:45. So you'll be able to obviously see the front end and the back end in a big celebration, and we have a lot of activities planned for Main Street and our local organizing committee there as well. So it really is the climactic moment when we finish the Tour of Utah and have our overall champion.
Right. A lot of fun. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Frank Zhang, Vice President of Communications for Larry H. Miller Tour of Utah, thank you so much for joining us this morning with this update. My final guest this morning is John Moss. He's Communications Director for the Wasatch County School District. Thank you so much for your willingness to come on here this morning.
Oh, good morning, Carolyn.
Yeah, so we there was a big Wasatch County School District Board meeting last night, and it was the truth and taxation hearing, and I'm hoping we could get an update on just what came out of that and what kind of input the board received.
Sure, you bet. Those are always interesting meetings. It's never easy to raise the taxes of residents, including ourselves. but we had a real fine attendance last night. I think we had probably somewhere between 100 and 150 people there. It was spilling out into the hallway, as people did want to comment on it. And it was a quite spirited meeting.
Yeah. So can you tell us just an overview, what is this tax increase for, and what is the overall amount of the tax increase?
The important thing the district was going for with this tax increase is to increase the salary for the teachers. We are in a highly competitive market with Wasatch School District competing against Park City and the Wasatch Front schools and Utah County schools for the best teachers. And the salaries keep rising in each of these districts, and it puts pressure on each of us to keep our salaries current if we want to keep the best teachers. And so the Truth in Taxation hearing last night was to raise $5.8 million. That's what it will raise. And $3.6 million of that will go to teacher salaries, and the remainder will be going to property acquisition so that we can build future schools. We are growing at such a rate here. Wasatch County is the fastest growing county in the state of Utah and the fourth fastest growing county in the nation. And we are growing at such a rate that we need more schools. The influx of students here has just been amazingly complex.
Right, right, which we'll kind of transition into that discussion also regarding the bond initiative. But can you give us an idea then of did the board take a vote on the tax increase? Will it go into effect?
They did have a unanimous vote passing that Truth in Taxation proposal, and so that will go into effect. It was interesting. We spent some time looking at how that will affect each taxpayer. And the way the Truth in Taxation works is the certified tax rate is driven down every year by the growth that comes in the valley, and the numbers get really hard to understand when you look at your property tax notice. So we tried to put these numbers in perspective. A taxpayer next year will pay $2.64 per $100,000 of their residential home value more than they paid this year. So it's an increase, but it's not a huge increase. But if you look at it from where the certified tax rate would have driven it down had we left it alone, it looks like a huge increase. But the actual out-of-pocket money for a resident is much less than what they had thought.
Right. That's just because you're holding the levy steady, basically. So let's talk about the discussion on the $150 million bond, which I believe a decision had to be made on whether that would go on the ballot for November. And can you remind listeners what this is for?
Well, that actually wasn't addressed last night at the board meeting. That has been tabled until next Tuesday, and they'll be having another board meeting then, and they will be addressing that issue at that time.
Okay, so no decision yet on that, although it appears that it's
something we can't wait much longer. Our high school in just 2 years will be a 6A high school. That's how big we are. And this is explosive growth, Carolyn. I'm sure you're aware of this, but when I started teaching here 30 years ago, they were still driving cows down Main Street here in Heber City. And now here we are with a 6A high school. It's just the growth has been exponential.
Yes, and the city is looking, the district is looking at building a new high school and replacing a middle school in Midway. Is that
an elementary in Midway?
Elementary, apologies. And
And
does the at this point in time, as far as the high school, proposed high school, is the property secured already by the district, or does that have to be acquired? Is that part of the 150?
The property is under contract right now, and they're just completing their due diligence work on that. But all of those things are hopefully in place, and the goal would be, once they pass this this resolution, and if we were able to get the voters to approve it in November, is to be in that school somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 years from now.
That's a fast move. Okay. And, you know, we'll stay up to speed on that, because there isn't there a regulation 75 days prior
Correct.
To the election, this decision about it going on the ballot has to be made. And what has to happen next with respect to the school district? What are their obligations, you know, once it's voted on?
Once the resolution has been passed, then the district really has a limited amount of information we can put out. We are not allowed to campaign for it in any way. And so our information we'll be putting out will be just informational. And actually, the citizens will be making the decision whether they really want to have this or not.
Okay. That's exactly right. They will. So, And what time is this meeting on Tuesday? Where? And is it an open meeting to the public?
It is an open meeting. It'll be Tuesday evening at 6:30 in the Wasatch Education Center. That's 101 East, 200 North. And we welcome people to come on in and be involved in that. This is a a huge thing for our community to go from one high school to two high schools, and it's painful in a lot of ways. So it's something we do encourage people to become involved with.
Yeah, well, sounds like you had quite a turnout last night, and I imagine you'll see something similar on Tuesday. So anything...
I'm sorry, I lost you right there. The phone broke up.
Oh, yes, I said you had quite a turnout last night, and I'm sure you'll see another big show residents come out on Tuesday night when you have this discussion.
Well, and that's the way it should be. We really are a citizens-based organization doing what the community thinks is best for the kids, and having more involvement is always a plus.
Sure, sure. Anything else, John Moss, you want to say about the Wasatch County School District and the plans?
I was pleased last night. The result from the people that came in and spoke to the issue, of course, there were some that were desirable that we not increase taxes, but there were so many that just were favorable for this. In fact, I remember one older lady who was on, her husband was on disability, and she was struggling with a part-time job. And she says, please raise our taxes because I want my grandkids to have great education. And I think that's how a lot of people felt, is this is a good thing because it's good for kids.
Yeah. Well, keep us up to speed and enjoy your weekend. I heard a rumor that you've got a couple of new twin grandsons, which...
We were taking care of our twin grandsons, and that's... I'd forgotten what it was like to be a young parent.
Yeah, or learn what it's like to be an old parent. Hey, well, have some fun with that. Thanks again, John, for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. I appreciate it.